Welcome to the Sunshine Plate on Edible Radio. I'm your host, Amy Robb, and from the offices of Edible Northeast Florida Magazine, our show is a celebration of food and the people who make it in our region. On our show today, we're chatting with native Floridian Scott Meyer of Congreen Pen Farm. Scott grew up working summers for his dad in their family's nursery business, and after he left home for school, he worked as a biologist in Wyoming before returning to Florida to complete a master's degree in aquaculture. At 29, Scott is one of Northeast Florida's younger farmers, and he's experimenting with a variety of crops that aren't typically grown in our region, like rice, mahas, and muscadine grapes. This is, of course, exactly what makes Congreen Pen so interesting to us. Scott Meyer, welcome to the Sunshine Plate.
It's nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Scott, I've been having this reoccurring question in my mind that I'm dying to ask you. When you were growing up, did you ever have the sense that you wanted to be a farmer? Did you absolutely dream of making that your profession?
No, I think that, you know, growing up, I had a lot of different interests, both in the arts and also in the sciences. I worked with my dad for the tree nursery and potting up trees and doing things like that, but also had a creative streak running through me, so I was looking at both the fine arts and engineering, I guess, by the time I was leaving Jacksonville. And surprisingly, I'm back here now farming.
Great. And so you, one of the things you studied, you got your master's degree in aquaculture. How did you become interested in aquaculture?
Well, I guess it all started, you know, with my overall interest in environmental sciences and the conservation ecology and things of that nature. I was already into environmental science here in high school in Jacksonville, and then kind of continued that, and that was my degree in college. But a lot of my focus was on marine research, so I spent a lot of time doing field work in the Turks and Caicos, also out in the Seychelles, but then while in school out in Texas, which is doing similar research out at the Fort Worth Nature Reserve and doing soil samples and vegetation and kind of seeing the familiarities both between studying, you know, the plants and the insects of the land and also, you know, it's the same thing as going out and diving on coral reefs. And, you know, by the time I was out in Wyoming studying a wide variety of things, you know, you're starting to view the sagebrush country as similar to the coral reefs, and you're studying, you know, the frogs and the lizards and the vegetation structure of rangeland. And it's all very very similar stuff if you look at it in the broader sense, but then also there's something new to find within it all.
Oh, interesting. You're currently growing rice. Has your development of the rice paddies on the farm been at all related to your aquaculture studies?
Yeah, when we originally were looking at trying to grow some rice here in Jacksonville, one of the main things I was looking at is their potential use as the rice paddies, that is, their use as a filtration for fish production. And it's something I'm still interested in pursuing. Looking at, hopefully, this winter, if not moving into the early spring, at putting in some catfish ponds where I'll be using the rice paddies as an extensive filtration system, thereby cleaning up the water on its way into the natural watershed from the fish production side of things, but then at the same time gaining the benefit of the fish waste fertilizer that'll be settling out in the rice field.
Wow. So you've got a number of things planned for the farm. You've got a number of interesting things going on at the farm. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you're currently growing? I don't think that people always associate Florida with being a place where rice would grow, or for that matter, maybe where mahas would grow.
Sure. So, you know, right now we've got, it's actually 6 rice paddies this year. We added a couple more, and we're looking at probably adding some more every year when we get a chance to kind of do more development-based activities on the farm in the wintertime. We kind of set out to have planted this past November 500 mayhaw trees, but we ended up getting ahead of schedule and having over 1,500 trees in the ground now. But actually, we had about 700 mayhaw trees in the ground when I was about 7 years old, and we were starting to get some yield, and we're making some jelly and all sorts of good stuff, but the city ended up buying out that land we were doing that on from us, and then it's something that my dad and myself have always been kind of interested in getting back into, and we've kind of started running with it, and we've got over 24 acres of mayhaw now planted with irrigation already run and trees already grafted to add another 10 acres this fall.
Wow. So if I remember correctly, you actually sought out very specific high-yield scions to graft onto Florida rootstock for those mejas. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and why you chose that route?
Sure. So, you know, with the meja tree, you know, like any fruit-bearing tree, there's different varieties and selections and sometimes hybrids that are better yielding or more disease-resistant. The trees we actually had planted back in the 90s, those were actually selections out of Texas made by a man named Lewis Talbert. And he was out near Gist, Texas, and they were the Texas Star and the Royal Star. And then since we went on about a 15-year hiatus from growing mejas, those trees were actually hybridized, becoming the Double G. So Billy Kraft, a gentleman out in western Louisiana, he actually took the pollen from a Texas Star, put that in with the Royal Star, while also removing the Royal Star's, that particular flower on the Royal Star's ability to create pollen so that it can itself pollinate, put a bag over it, and then that keeps bees from getting in there and also disrupting this purposeful cross-pollination. And then the five seeds from the fruit he planted, and one of those seeds grew into what is now the Double G. And so we've got about 700 Double G's in the ground right now. It's a very nice tree, and it's superior to the Texas Star and the Royal Star on a couple fronts, being that the yield is just as good, if not greater. It has better resistance to fire blight, which is a pretty bad disease you can get in both apple trees and the meja trees and other trees. Also, it has a little bit later bloom date, and so that's a very big factor in the meja, is that you want the blooms to come on as late as possible. That way, if you have a hard freeze late in February or early in March, you're going to avoid losing your whole crop for the year, because the trees are just going to bloom one time and then bear fruit one time, and then you got to wait again until next year. So it's a lot better to have a tree blooming in late February, even into March, than an early February blooming tree. And then kind of beyond that, the Double G is in and of itself kind of one of the earlier cultivars now, and that's been hybridized with the Maxine, which is a native selection from Louisiana that tends to be, out of the selections, like a non-hybridized tree, a tree that's just a pure wild selection that cuttings have been taken from. That's one of the leaders in the industry. And then that's been crossed with the Double G, resulting in both the Surprise and the Red Champ. So those are the four varieties, the Double G, the Maxine, the Red Champ, as well as the Surprise, and then a few additional varieties from my mentor, Jimmy Moore, up in Valdosta, Georgia, like the Big Gem and the Cherry Red that we're growing out here.
Wow. So the next question that comes to mind is, what the heck are you going to do with all those mejas? I'm sure you must have a plan.
We've got a pretty good plan. For the most part, you can't ever go wrong making some really nice meja jelly, but we've already begun to diversify a little bit. We've been making a meja shrub, a drinking vinegar that's been really popular. The meja goes really nice, both with rum and bourbon and even just as a refreshing soda. And then we're actually in the long run looking at, you know, once our yields are really getting up there, just pressing the juice and fermenting it to make a nice crab apple cider.
Wonderful. So Northeast Florida's first crab apple cider.
That's correct. And what's cool about the meja is that it's just a native tree that obviously we've gotten some good selections that'll actually be able to make it commercially viable. But then beyond that, I mean, apple trees just don't grow this far south, and most people who are making cider in the South tend to be sourcing their fruit from afar, whether it be North Carolina, you know, out into Washington and Oregon, or even internationally.
Mm. So you also have muscadine grapes on the property. Is the plan for those also to press them and turn them into some sort of beverage?
Yeah, so with the muscadines, we'll actually be doing a U-pick this year in the end of August and early September. But we'll also be beginning to experiment on both a shrub. And I've always, you know, muscadine wine, you know, a lot of people, they tend to not believe that it's the best wine, or it's been off-putting due to its overt sweetness and dessert style. I'm interested in seeing if we can't, you know, do a drier fermentation, even if it means watering down the juice a little bit to get your initial bricks lower so you can actually have a dried out fermentation. There's a lot of room to play there, and we'll eventually be yielding quite a bit of muscadines, and I'm sure we'll come up with some great products to make from them.
How did you come up with this assortment of crops? I mean, from rice to muscadine grapes to mejas, it seems sort of an unlikely course. I don't know any other farms that have quite that same combination of crops, especially not in this region, and none that I know of nationally, really. What was the process like in choosing these crops?
Sure. So, initially, this farm had been being used by my father for doing landscape nursery trees like live oaks and magnolias and the like. And then just from experience working out here, is always very wet. And so, we're thinking of things that aren't going to need poorly drained soil. So first thing you think of is rice. While you don't think of rice being a crop in Northeast Florida, Northeast Florida is kind of the southern end of the original rice production in the United States that stretched all the way up into southern North Carolina. And we knew that the climate was fine for it. Rice is grown between, some pretty broad ranges of latitudes internationally. And it's really a matter of, are you having the water? Because it does like to be wet. It's a wetland grass crop. And we actually have a clay layer in our soil naturally. It's a blue, kind of really, really fine clay that just traps water in. It's why the farm was always muddy and kind of a mess, and what we did was we just leveled the first 4 acres of land and saved a little bit of the extra dirt to build up some berms around the fields, and it's been a pretty dry year, but the fields have stayed pretty wet overall when we've gotten the sparse amounts of rain that we have. And beyond that, that's kind of why we were looking at the rice. And furthermore, from that point we kind of went into the meha, knowing that this is a tree that naturally, it's a native tree to this area, all the way into East Texas from here along the I-10 corridor. And it likes to be wet as well. So, it's a little bit, we're a little bit north in the first place for citrus, but also citrus trees love being, having dry roots. They like to get watered, but they don't like to have their roots saturated for weeks at a time. And they just do well in wet conditions. So we did that. And then, with the muscadine, it's another native to the southeast. So going with native species beyond the rice is obviously not native to the area, but it likes the water, and then going with native species that, typically like the woods and the swampy areas like that. With the muscadines, however, we did bedrow them because they don't like to be quite as wet as the mejas, so we just plowed some beds and planted them about, a foot above grade, and they seem to be doing really well.
Wonderful. So I'm going to shift gears here for a minute, and I'm curious about some of the biggest challenges you've had, not necessarily in growing crops on your property, but in the overall development of Congaree and Penn Farm. Can you tell us a little bit about that, maybe where you started and what you've now become, or what some of the biggest hurdles to getting where you're going are at the moment?
Sure. I mean, a big part of it to me is staying focused. While it might seem like I've got kind of all these different directions I'm heading in, a lot of my customers, but also myself, our minds wander, and we have big ideas about being even more diversified as a small farm. And, beyond that, the focus kind of side of things, really coming up with realistic expectations of what you can get done, and then just having that work ethic to go and get it all done. The roadblocks we've hit is that the farm, used to be a cattle farm, then it was a tree nursery, and then it kind of had been not as well kept, so a lot of just overall cleaning up of the property has really chewed up the clock quite a bit on, months and months of getting everything looking nice. And then at the same rate, just kind of the learning curve of trying some of these new things and figuring out what's the best way to do stuff. And I mean, we kind of continually keep on improving, and I think that's a big part of it as well, is just not thinking that you've already got it figured out or that you know everything, but being open to learning new stuff and always be talking to other people doing, different crops in the same area, see what their problems have been. And then, the biggest thing really is just the, finding ways to work with the USDA as a young farmer and also a farmer without the years of experience that you need to be able to qualify for some of the programs that are beneficial. It's a very, people think that farming might be an easy thing to get into, but at the end of the day, I had a lot of legs up on, you know, having some land and, you know, having a decent idea of what I want to do and at least some experience both in the sciences and in agriculture itself. But there's a lot of barriers to entry in that world of agriculture as a young person. But now that we're in our third year, that's kind of the magic number with regard to being eligible for different grants and loans through the USDA is having at least 3 years of experience growing the crops that you're growing. And so now that we're wrapping up our third harvest of rice out here, you know, we're kind of more eligible for some things, but at the same time, maybe we're not looking for grants or loans anymore because we've already kind of figured out how to make do without.
Right.
If that makes any sense. So it's always interesting, but there's a lot of people out there that are very supportive. And I think a big thing is just being focused, but being, you know, open to all communications and all ideas from a wide variety of people.
Yeah. You and your wife, Lindsay, do a lot of community outreach and you do a lot of promotion at farmers markets for your product. You both have seemed really actively involved in marketing your products and bringing your products to market. Is that something you anticipated and in fact enjoy about the process, that sort of entrepreneurial part of the business? Or is it something that feels increasingly like maybe a burden?
No, it's something that I believe I enjoy, you know, the connection to both the consumer, but also kind of educating about, you know, how food is produced and how it's made and, you know, where it comes from. And my wife and I both met at school and she was in graphic design. I also did some printmaking in addition to the environmental science. And, you know, we both love good packaging and good design. And we growing up and being together and living in a few different areas, whenever we'd be out at the grocery store or whatever, we'd be, you know, sometimes shopping with our eyes. And, you know, by the time we started producing these food products, it was kind of a no-brainer that we wanted everything to be designed very well, catch people's eye, and, you know, hopefully be able to use good design to perpetuate what we're trying to do out here, make it both financially and, you know, sustainable as a business. So, you know, I think that starting small, you've got to try to get the most value out of your products. And one of the best ways to do that is to use good design and good marketing. Because if you don't have a lot to rely on, you know, when I'm growing 4 acres of rice and that's the only product I've got to sell for the first 2 years, but I'm also spending the money of putting in the irrigation and planting and grafting, you know, another 30 acres of orchard, that puts a lot of strain on, you know, the amount of rice you have to sell. And from that point, you know, good design has been very beneficial to getting our products out into more stores, and good marketing has connected us to lots of good restaurants and different events around Northeast Florida.
Oh, wonderful. Well, Scott, is there anything else that you would like to tell us about Congaree and Penn? Anything else you'd like to share with us? It has been such a treat to hear some of the things that you've gone through in the last 3 years as you've kind of kickstarted this project that you've got on your hands. Is there anything else that we haven't talked about today?
I don't know. I would say that overall, it's been very, very enjoyable. It's been probably just as much work, if not more, than I anticipated, but it's also the idea of just being open to evolution. So when we started out, the rice was actually destined to become sake, but then along the road of looking like that's going to eat up, you know, 3 years of figuring out and eat up all the money we have moving forward, chefs were interested in someone growing rice locally, and we've kind of been able to pivot into doing a lot of food rice products. And then that's kind of parlayed itself into doing additional food products and going in an entirely different direction. And, you know, after our first rice harvest was the first time we started talking about the Mahas, and, you know, we knew we had the right land and we were starting to, you know, put in the work to clean up this farm, and we're much more well-versed in trees than necessarily rice in the first place. So kind of going towards something we had already done, but in a new way and in a more advanced way, has really been paying off. And it's exciting to see the farm grow in that way.
Scott Meyer, Congreen Penn Farm, I want to thank you for being with us today. Folks, you heard it here. Agility, openness, creativity. It's truly one of the new faces of farming, especially in our region in Northeast Florida. Scott, again, thank you for being with us. We look forward to many more visits to your farm and to seeing what Congreen Penn will produce next.
Thank you, Amy. It was nice being here.
You've been listening to The Sunshine Plate. Thanks for joining us on Edible Radio. Check us out at ediblefeast.com.